Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Michaela Tyler from Aspen High School, Sophia Nelson from Glenwood High School, and physicist Brian Battelle from Pittsburgh University. We'll begin today with Sophia.
Hello, my name's Sophia. I'm a student at Linda Floor's AP Physics class at Glenwood Springs High School, and I've been a gopher for this past week, and it's been a great experience. I've learned a lot about particle physics and dark matter. My first question to you, Brian, is did you always want to be a physicist when you grew up?
I think when I was young, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I guess I really became interested in physics when I was in university. What drew me to physics was just after I started taking classes, I started to really understand that you could describe all of the natural phenomena with very precise, very elegant mathematical laws, mathematical rules, and this just fascinated me. So this is where I really became interested in physics, and then I went on into grad school. The longer I stayed in it, the more I got in deep, basically, and now I'm stuck. So.
I'm Michaela Tyler, and I'm a student at Aspen High School. I'm in Mark Whitley's IB Physics class, and today is my first day at the Physics Center. I'm very excited for my next week. I can't wait to meet all the different physicists and learn some more about all the different things they're working on. And my first question for you, Brian, is when you were in university and studying physics for your first few years, what did the physicists at the time know about particle physics?
When I was in university, I personally knew very little about particle physics, probably nothing when I started, of course, and really didn't learn about particle physics in detail until I got to graduate school. So we knew quite a bit at that time. So I went to university sort of late 90s, and essentially we have a description of fundamental interactions between matter, forces, elementary particles. It's called the Standard Model. And that had already been established essentially in the 70s and 80s and 90s. There was one missing ingredient that hadn't been discovered when I entered physics, which is called the Higgs boson. Perhaps we'll get into this in more detail, but the Higgs boson is an essential ingredient in this Standard Model, and it's essentially responsible for giving all of the elementary particles mass. And so that was the big thing that happened since I've entered the field of particle physics. Was the discovery of the Higgs boson.
Can you explain more of what the Standard Model is?
You've, of course, learned in your physics classes and chemistry classes that matter is composed of atoms at a basic level. And then if you look a little bit deeper, atoms are made up of nucleus, and electrons that sort of orbit the nucleus. And then you can look even deeper and deeper into the nucleus. So you find protons and neutrons, and then you can look deeper into these objects, and you find that they're made out of even smaller elementary particles called quarks. And the atoms themselves, well, you can ask, well, why does an electron and a nucleus, why are they held together? What does that? And that's because of a force, a fundamental force called the electromagnetic force. So it's just the same force that is responsible for, you know, electricity, magnetism that you're familiar with. And then you can look inside the proton and the neutron, and you find that the quarks that are making up those objects are also held together by another force. It's called the strong force. So basically, over the last, I'd say, 50 years or so, we've come to understand that there are three basic forces responsible for all of the interactions in matter. That's the electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force. And we've discovered a range of different elementary particles, some of which you're familiar with, like the electron, the quarks maybe that we just discussed. There are other particles too. But essentially, it's this framework. I don't want to make it sound like it's sort of just a stamp collecting. We're collecting different particles and forces. These are the ingredients. But really, the laws and the mathematical equations that describe these interactions are very beautiful, very elegant, and very simple. You can write them down on a T-shirt, essentially. And you can even probably buy that T-shirt on Amazon or something. But so it's this framework, essentially, this mathematical framework and these different ingredients that go in, which really describe at a very basic level all of the interactions and constituents of matter. That's the standard model.
When you say it's a pretty basic standard of model, why do you think that this model hadn't been discovered until more recently in physics studies?
Yeah, you can go back, to ancient times even, and people were thinking about these questions, right? Like, what is stuff made of? And the idea of an atom, it goes back even to the ancient Greeks, to Democritus. And so, these questions are sort of eternal questions that we've been thinking about them. People have been wondering about them, since probably, people started thinking outside of, how am I going to survive and get food today and that sort of thing. Now, more recently, say at the turn of the century, we started to really probe into the structure of matter at a very deep level. So there was the discovery of the electron. Later, there was the discovery of the nucleus by Rutherford. And so on and so on. And what's essentially made this possible is of course, experiments. So physics and science in general, we shouldn't just think of the ideas. The really important thing are the experiments. The experiments decide whether or not an idea is correct or it's incorrect, or you should toss it out the window. And so over this century, there's been a steady increase in these type of experiments, which have allowed us to probe deeper and deeper into the structure of matter. It's like taking a microscope and we're trying to zoom in at the very smallest distance scales and kind of peel back each layer to see what nature reveals. And I can talk a little bit about the kind of experiments that we do. Essentially, the microscope that we use are called accelerator experiments or collider experiments. We take particles and we try to smash them together as hard as we can, and we try to see what comes out of those collisions. And by doing that, by studying these events, the debris that comes out of the collisions, we can then kind of work back and try to infer what happened at the very short distances. And then we can test different ideas, different theories. So really what has taken us so long to establish the basic picture of particle physics, of the standard model, is just that, the technology kept progressing and progressing. It took some time. And then eventually we've done enough experiments and a picture emerged which passes all the different experimental tests, and that's the standard model.
Can you name some of the particle accelerators that are being used to study these?
Sure. So right now, the big experiment right now, the big accelerator facility, is the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah.
And that's in Geneva, Switzerland. It's at CERN, which is the European Laboratory for Nuclear Physics. Although there have been many attempts in the past to try to find the Higgs, it's been a very elusive particle. So, for example, here in the United States, there's the laboratory near Chicago called Fermilab, and they had an experiment, an accelerator called the Tevatron, and there were also searches for the Higgs there, but unfortunately they didn't find it. And basically, the reason we had to keep going up essentially to higher and higher energy. So the Tevatron was operating at a very high energy, an energy which is called 2 TeV. TeV is sort of, if you want to think of it in terms of the mass, it's like 1,000 times the mass of the proton. That's the energy involved. So that wasn't high enough energy, so we had to go even to higher energies. And at the Large Hadron Collider, which is about 7 times the energy of the Tevatron, we were able to discover the Higgs.
When you say discover the Higgs, you mean sort of observe the debris that it caused in the collision. Will you just explain a little bit about the experiment to discover the Higgs?
Sure. So in these type of experiments, and in particular the one at CERN, the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, the basic idea is that we're colliding protons. So there's an underground ring with very powerful magnets that accelerate protons in different directions. And at a couple of points along the ring, there are detectors, very sophisticated devices that try to observe this debris. So the protons will come in very fast, and they're made to collide sort of at the center of these detectors. And then all of the debris kind of goes outward. And so you can think of this detector as kind of an onion that wraps around the ring. And it has different layers that are used for detecting essentially different types of particles that come out. And so what we do is we study all of these different collisions. And most of the collisions are kind of, you know, boring. They're sort of, we understand what happened. They're maybe low energy collisions or very soft particles that come out, and they're not necessarily interesting. They're not necessarily telling us about heavy particles like the Higgs. But occasionally there's a very interesting event that could be, you know, a sign of the Higgs boson or something else that we're interested in. We look for those type of events. So for example, when we discover the Higgs, what can happen is that the protons can collide, and you could actually convert that energy in the collision into a Higgs boson. So you can transform the energy into the mass of the Higgs boson, essentially by using Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared. So you can convert energy E into the mass m. And so then when you make the Higgs, essentially what it does is it decays or disintegrates immediately into other particles that we're familiar with. And so, for example, it could decay into two photons. Photons are particles essentially of light. They're the particles that mediate the electromagnetic force that we mentioned. So you collide protons, and they could make a Higgs particle, and then the Higgs particle could decay back into two photons, and then you could observe those two photons. Now, it's not as simple as that. You know, you don't just look for events with two photons, because there are lots of different processes in these collisions that could make two photons. So those are called background events. Those would be background to the signal, which is the Higgs boson. So we have to do a little bit more complicated analysis and look for some distinguishing feature. But essentially what you would see is you'd see like a resonance in some distribution. It's like, you know, you dial your radio. At some point you'll hear the station come up, and you've hit the resonance where that station is broadcasting. And essentially you can do this a similar thing when you look in these two photon events. You can look in the mass distribution, or the invariant mass distribution it's called, of these two photons, and you would see a resonance or a bump. And that would tell you essentially that you've seen something new.
You're listening to KDNK, community-supported radio in Carbondale, Colorado. The program is Radio Physics, which airs the last Tuesday of every month at 4:30.
In research, I found something that came up like really interesting is that for these collisions to happen, the temperature needs to be lower than that of outer space. Is that like correct? Or?
Right. So essentially, the technology that we use to accelerate the protons relies on these very powerful magnets, and they're so-called superconducting magnets. So to make them so powerful, we need to cool these magnets to very low temperatures, and so even below the temperature in outer space.
When you use the metaphor of changing your frequency on your radio, are you changing the speed in the experiments or how fast the particles are accelerating to get the outcome that is observed for Higgs boson?
Sure. Well, so it's not quite like that. So essentially, for example, if we can look at the Higgs boson again, so we look for events with two photons, for example, because that could be a signature of the Higgs. Now, there are lots of things that make these two photon events, lots of different processes. So what we do is we collect all of those two photon events, and then we'll look at different distributions of those things. So maybe there's a quantity that would be interesting. So one quantity, if you can think about it, is we can take the two photons' momentum and add them together, and then they could add up to some quantity, which is the invariant mass. And then what we would do is like we'd make a figure or a plot of those two photon events. We'd kind of scan through it, and we would see if there's any kind of blip, like a bump. So that's like the analogy with dialing your radio. You're sort of you're just looking through those two photon events, looking in this distribution, and seeing if something sticks out above this background. Okay. So that's basically the analogy. So it's nothing to do with changing the experiment per se, but it's just examining the data that comes out and looking for kind of an anomalous feature that wouldn't be explained by just ordinary processes.
So typically everything in the experiment is held constant.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we hold, you know, the energy constant. Sort of the number of collisions is held roughly constant. Although we always try to increase these things to get more and more collisions, but roughly the operating conditions of the experiment are held stable.
Great.
So what you learned in undergraduate school, do you still use it in your research that you do today?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So physics is a huge subject. So, you know, it starts off with, probably you've taken, you know, sort of classical mechanics where you're studying kinematics, like motion of particles and Newton's laws and this sort of stuff. You certainly use those type of things in a sense, in that, you know, physics builds up on each, you know, each additional subject that you learn kind of builds on the previous subject. And in particular, the methods, like the problem-solving methods that you use for each subject are, you know, kind of cumulative, and you keep building and building new problem-solving methods, and intuition too. And so intuition is a very important tool of a physicist. So when we're trying to solve different problems, what we're really trying to do probably first is just get an intuition. We're trying to wrap our brain around a given problem and try to just get a physical picture in our head. Not necessarily, you know, we're just going to attack with some, you know, take some equations and start manipulating. We're trying to really get a picture in our head. So certainly there are aspects of, you know, there's certainly tools that come from undergraduate physics that I still use in my research, and even particular subjects like, you know, quantum mechanics. All of this stuff is useful in my current research. But I think the most important thing that I use is just the tools, the problem-solving tools, and sort of this idea of trying to get intuition for a problem.
So going back to the study of the Higgs boson, for these sort of properties that scientists are observing to be correct, you guys have sort of deduced the Higgs field. So could you explain a little bit about the Higgs field and how it's constant, like, throughout the universe from what we know?
It's a very good question, and it's a very difficult thing to explain. So let me try to make an analogy. So the Higgs particle, or the Higgs boson, or the Higgs field, they're all kind of different manifestations of one entity. So the way elementary particles get mass is through interacting with the Higgs field. And so, to draw an analogy, if you think of like a bar magnet, so you're familiar with that. So if you take like a paperclip and you bring it near a bar magnet, you can certainly feel like there's some force acting on the paperclip, right? In a similar way, the Higgs field interacts with ordinary particles. And as particles move through this field, they experience a type of force, which effectively you can describe as the particles getting a mass. So that's essentially the way we think about it. And basically the way we understand it now is that throughout all of the universe, throughout all of space, there's a constant Higgs field. And that's what's responsible for giving all particles mass. If you turned off that field, that would mean that all the particles would be essentially massless, and our universe would be very different.
What's like the future of the particle research?
We certainly are still excited that we've discovered the Higgs particle, but that's certainly not the end of the story. So there's many different reasons, both sort of theoretical puzzles that we don't know how to answer yet, and also just cold, hard, empirical facts, which basically tell us that there has to be some new particles or some new physics that goes beyond the standard model, which is their current description of elementary particles and forces. So what we're doing, a huge part of the program in particle physics research, is trying to search for new phenomena, whether it be some new particles or just some other type of new phenomena that we haven't seen, just maybe trying to test the standard model and see if it breaks somewhere. So, for example, at the Large Hadron Collider, We not only are looking for Higgs particles, but we're looking for all kinds of exotic new particles. So one thing would be maybe dark matter. So a variety of different astrophysical observations and cosmological observations tell us that all the stuff that we're made of, all the particles in the Standard Model, actually don't make up most of the matter in the universe. There's actually has to be some other matter to provide the sort of gravitational sources for all kinds of different phenomena. One possibility, a very simple economical possibility, is that there's just some new stable particle in the universe, and this could be the dark matter. And so we're trying to search for that at the Large Hadron Collider and a variety of other different experiments. So this is really the direction right now. Is we have the Standard Model. It's very successful experimentally. It has a nice, beautiful theoretical description. But there's a number of different problems, dark matter, other things like neutrino mass. Neutrinos are a very light particle that somehow obtain mass, but we don't really know how they obtain mass. We don't know why there's more matter in the universe than antimatter. You probably heard that of antimatter. There, mm-hmm. Like, for example, for every particle like the electron, there's an antiparticle like the positron. Every elementary particle has this sort of partner. But in the universe, we don't see that. We just see matter particles. And it's a mystery why that happens. So we're trying to search for new phenomena which could shed some light on those mysteries.
For your personal career in physics, what will you be sort of beginning to study now, and what's your future in physics?
It's not really clear. I certainly am interested in a huge number of different questions, but what I work on, you know, from one month to another, it changes. And that can be because maybe there's a new experimental result which comes up, which looks really interesting, and that could maybe shed some light on some of these mysteries that we mentioned. Or there's a new theoretical idea. Maybe I'm talking with a collaborator and we think of some new idea that could maybe explain, you know, some of these questions. And so that's what's actually really exciting about being a theoretical physicist, is that you don't really know what you're going to be working on from, say, one month to the next. But certainly there are a number of open questions that sort of drive my curiosity. And, you know, dark matter is one question. So I work a lot on sort of theories of dark matter and how to test them experimentally. I work on models of the Higgs boson. So there's a simple model of the Higgs boson, which is in the Standard Model. But there's a number of different shortcomings of this model. In particular, we don't understand really why the Higgs boson is as light as it is. Quantum mechanics would actually suggest that it's much heavier than what we observe it at the Large Hadron Collider. So that's a very interesting open question that leads to a lot of interesting different theoretical possibilities. And so I work on those. I try to think of ways to test those. But there's just a lot of different open questions. I can probably, you know, a dozen or so, which drive my research. But the most exciting thing is basically if there's some new discovery, some new experimental discovery. That's what we're all hoping for. And if that happens, you know, that will just be a complete blast to try to interpret that, make sense of it, and because that will lead us to the next layer in the structure of matter, essentially.
Thank you so much, Brian Battelle from the University of Pittsburgh, and Sophia Nelson from Glenwood Springs High School, Michaela Tyler from Aspen High School. This is Patty Fox. You've been listening to Radio Physics. Thank you.